The one thing that tends to be mistaken about ADHD is clients will often say, I struggle with one particular aspect of my attention and my attention span, yet I'm able to almost hyper-focus on something, whether it's a craft or a hobby or something else. And that is the hallmark of it. And that goes with children as well.
Welcome to Everything is Clinical, a podcast for mental health clinicians. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Jackie Dunnigan, a licensed marriage and family therapist. I'm also an AAMFT approved supervisor. And I do believe that when it comes to the therapy room, everything is clinical. I hope you get as much value out of listening to these discussions with various seasoned professionals as I did in having them. Rachel Shanefield is with us today, and Rachel is a licensed psychologist and who specializes in the treatment of children, adolescents, young adults, parents, and families. And Rachel, I know you work with a lot of different disorders in the treatment, but you also do assessments, and that's what we're going to be talking about today is the assessments for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or as we'll probably call it throughout the rest of the podcast, ADHD. Thank you for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Rachel, before we jump in, let me just get a little bit of hearing a little bit about your practice and your background, particularly when it comes to this. So if clinicians are looking to refer to you, what they can know to expect with who you are, where you're at.
Well, I have a range of expertise as a clinical psychologist and also as a nationally certified school psychologist. So I kind of meld educational components with the clinical components, but I also, not just school-age children, can go through young adulthood. And as you mentioned, I work with a range of different types of challenges, anxiety, depression, educational issues, mood disorders, behavior management. ADHD is a big one. I think one of the things for my practice is people may come in or clients may seek a referral and think it's one particular challenge and it ends up becoming something else when we dig a little deeper. So I provide consultative services. So I may have clients seek me out to get some feedback or recommendations for school, life, work, but therapy may focus on any of those particular disorders. But if we're talking about ADHD, you know, how to manage that. So therapy can be provided, and then also assessments. I provide a range of psychological evaluations for a whole host of areas.
What are some of the other areas, Rachel, real quick, other than ADHD, that you provide assessments for?
I'll have clients come in and report having significant challenges in school or work. So whether that's due to learning or memory issues or holding up their responsibilities, they may have concerns, like I said, with their learning style or work performance. In addition to that, attention, as we're talking about today, tends to be a big one. Difficulty focusing, completing tasks, which I know we'll get into a little bit more. I have clients that come in saying, I have really significant anxiety and depression. I want to dig a little deeper and really understand that. I will look at mood disorders, any kind of personality disorders. And then again, as it refers to probably more school age individuals, taking a look at all the different components of that, maybe school refusal, it may be something related to social skills, self-awareness, self-esteem, those types of things. My evaluations really encompass a whole host of areas, like I mentioned, and they're tailored specifically to the client's needs.
Well, specifically with ADHD, let's dive in a little bit with that. If a clinician is treating somebody who they believe may be struggling with ADHD. What are some of the symptoms they should pay attention to, some of the behaviors they should be paying attention to as clinicians?
The analogy I like to start off with is for somebody who's experiencing attention difficulties, if we think about, we open up a Google Chrome browser and we have multiple tabs opened up at the same time. And sometimes it's multiple tabs for the same type of content. Sometimes it's many tabs of different content. And we kind of forget what some of the tabs are for. We may think, all right, I keep opening up new ones. I'm overwhelmed. I can't navigate it. And then if we think of it in terms of like the computer's RAM or memory, it may freeze up. It kind of is like that whole process of keeping track of tasks. It could be starting and completing tasks. It can be forgetfulness. It can be difficulty with multi-step directions or instructions or tasks. It can also involve a high level of distractibility. That tends to be a big one. And alongside that, there are more behavioral type components of attention. What I just described is more under the umbrella of inattention and having that kind of short attention span and those associated behaviors. But then with more of the impulsive, the hyperactive impulsive type, we're looking at pretty excessive restlessness. Can't sit still, this need to get up, feeling like they're driven by motor. Fidgetiness, just cannot keep their hands, like not playing with something. And then more in an interactual level, we'll see like interrupting others, blurting out, difficulty waiting their turn. And really with those types of behaviors, the big piece is because as humans, we exhibit these kinds of behaviors.
Right.
The key component is how much of an impact it's having on one's day-to-day life.
Okay, so how much it's getting in the way, is that what you're saying?
Right, so what that could mean is essentially, are they having trouble in interpersonal relationships, difficulty keeping, maintaining friends or peers? It could mean that they're having difficulty navigating school, whether it's through academic performance and then in a job setting, difficulty holding up their responsibilities, missing deadlines, forgetting things, not being able to follow through with multiple steps or tasks that are being asked.
So it's attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Do you need both attention deficit and hyperactivity for a diagnosis of ADHD?
There are three subtypes of ADHD, the first being the inattentive type. And that pertains to the short attention span, the distractibility, the forgetfulness, difficulty starting and completing tasks, a tendency to give up easily and can't really sustain that effort. Even though we all struggle with that, again, if it's more of a pervasive pattern. So that really falls under the umbrella of inattentive type behaviors and symptoms. The next subtype is what we call the hyperactive impulsive type. And that pertains to, like I had mentioned, the restlessness, the fidgety behavior, interrupting, blurting out, can't wait their turn, talking excessively tends to be a big one, kind of being on the go. Part of the impulsive aspect of that is doing things without thinking through them first. So acting kind of without thinking about the outcomes or consequences. And then the last subtype of ADHD is what we call the combined presentation. So that involves the inattentive type symptoms as well as the hyperactive impulsive type. So somebody can meet the criteria for one of those subtypes depending on the symptoms that they present with.
And I love that you went through those subtypes. I think that really gives some clarity because I think so often we get stuck on sometimes that hyperactivity piece and may look at it and say, well, things don't really, you know, add up to all of those things. And I just tell you, Rachel, as you were giving the browser analogy, I'm thinking that's me, right? Where I have like all of a sudden, you know, 15 tabs open. And as I glance across them, I have no clue what I was doing. I totally can get that. But as you said, it's also the level of impairment that we're looking at. How much is it getting in the way of everyday functioning, of relationships. Do you see generally a big difference in presentation between children and adults? Is symptomology any different?
That's a great question. Typically, what we tend to see is more of the hyperactivity tends to taper off as children get older, and we see less of that in adults. With that being said, it does not indicate that adults don't exhibit restless, fidgety type behaviors. But generally, the types of symptoms in childhood or in adulthood manifest a little differently. Clearly, if you're not in school and you're dealing with work type responsibilities and tasks and more household type responsibilities, chores and things like that, it may look a little bit different. But in terms of symptomology, it tends to look the same. It just the context of it is a little bit different. Now, the distinction between, and going back to diagnosis, is that not only are we looking at the severity of symptoms, the duration of them, and so on, there are also, in order for a diagnosis to be made, there are criteria that fall under the different subtypes that you have to exhibit. So, for instance, you need, up until age 16, you have to exhibit 6 of those symptoms in order to meet the criteria. After age 16, so 17 and beyond, 5 symptoms are required to meet that criteria. So we are looking at not only just meeting the criteria of the specific symptoms, but again, in combination with its interference of day-to-day life and severity and so on.
So a little less stricter meeting of the criteria for adults for a diagnosis of ADHD than children for a diagnosis of ADHD, which to me kind of makes sense, you know, whenever we're talking about treating children and, of course, children's behaviors as well. There's a lot more common behaviors that would fall within that, looking like they could look like ADHD. I know that when they refer to you, when a clinician refers to you, you're going to go through some assessments, which we're going to talk about in a moment here. But is there anything that a clinician who is not trained or qualified to do the full assessment can do as maybe a screening tool?
There is a measure called the Vanderbilt scales that is often used by primary care physicians and pediatricians. That is a screening measure that is a self-report. It can be completed by the individual. And then in the case of children, parents can complete it and teachers can complete it. And often that will inform the clinician, or sometimes I have clients that bring it directly to their pediatrician or primary care physician.
Good to know. At what point do you think it's worthwhile for a clinician to refer for the full evaluation for ADHD?
I think if the client is reporting that the potential symptoms of ADHD seem to be really interfering, if a client is saying, I'm really struggling, if we're talking about an adult, for instance, I'm really struggling to get tasks done at work, meet deadlines, work on multiple things simultaneously. I'm forgetting what I have to do. I really am having trouble navigating all the different things that come with my work responsibilities. It also could manifest at home. So I have trouble keeping up with chores, again, in the context of not just I'm not motivated to do it and I don't feel like doing the laundry today, but more along the lines of it's really difficult for me to figure out where to start. I start and I stop. I can't finish it. I forget what I have to do, that type of thing. And then in an interpersonal setting, maybe I'm struggling to maintain relationships, or I find myself interrupting people all the time, or people are giving me feedback that it's hard to have a conversation with me because I'm often blurting things out, or I'm saying things impulsively and not thinking about how it's affecting other people. So again, the barometer tends to be how much it's impacting the client in terms of their day-to-day life, whether it's as young as a child all the way through adulthood. Also, I think alongside that is really at what point, when I have a clinician refer to me, they're saying, you know what, I'm not really sure what's going on. It may sound like an attention issue, But this client is also presenting with symptoms of anxiety or depression, and there's a lot of overlap that. And so what may look like ADHD can often be anxiety, because we know that if we're feeling on edge, we're restless, we're not sleeping well, we kind of, our tank is very limited, we don't have a lot of space in it, we aren't as engaged or focused and able to complete tasks. So clinicians can often seek an evaluation to differentiate what those diagnoses are and help determine, are there possibilities for alternative diagnoses? And then essentially, if a clinician's working with a client and says, I really need to tailor more specific interventions, I'm at a crossroad, or I need some guidance, that's another reason that clinicians will seek a referral for an evaluation as well.
Yeah, as you're saying that, I'm kind of going back and playing in my head, a lot of my clients, and I work with all adults except for in a family setting is where I'll work with children. But I'm curious, and I think you brought in something that I thought was really key there, is that some anxiety can look like ADHD. Depression can look like ADHD. Other disorders can look like ADHD. Is ADHD generally a lifelong condition?
Generally, because it is a biological type disorder and diagnosis. There's research and studies of the brain that have been conducted that indicate how the brain is functioning, a typically functioning brain for somebody who doesn't have ADHD versus somebody who does. That is something that's biological. So with that being said, is it doesn't necessarily go away. And really what the key piece is learning how to manage it, learning how to gain insight about one's strengths and challenges. And that's also where the clinician can come in too, to understand that, and an evaluation helps guide that as well. But really it is something that somebody has to manage throughout their lifetime. More of the outwardly external behaviors like the fidgetiness and restlessness tend to taper off for a lot of individuals, but it's really figuring out what are those strategies that work best for a given individual, because it's not a one-size-fits-all type approach. We create a toolbox of different types of strategies that people can pull from over time. It is something that people learn how to navigate in their life. Mm-hmm. And an assessment is really not just helpful for a clinician, but it really gives an opportunity for clients to gain insight into where their strengths are, where their challenges are. Like, it gives that aha moment of like, oh, this all finally makes sense. And now what do I do with it?
Yeah. And I hear that a lot from people who do the assessment piece, is they see that a lot in clients where when they get the details of the diagnosis, it is that aha moment. And there's a lot of relief because it gives a lot of hope to move forward. What are the benefits of getting the assessment to both the client and to the clinician?
A really big benefit here is it allows both the client and the clinician to get a very thorough understanding of, like I said, the strengths and the challenges. And on the client level, it can allow the client to gain more insight and self-awareness of him or herself, or in the case of a child. And what this can do is that level of self-awareness can really change the way somebody feels about themselves and can cascade into a lot of positive area. Because oftentimes clients will say, gosh, I feel like something's wrong with me. Why is this happening to me? I feel like everybody else around me doesn't have it like this, and it just seems like such a struggle. And really what we look at is not just the challenges from the assessment findings, but where are the strengths? Let's build upon that. And that's helpful for both the client and the clinician. It also can help, from a client standpoint, improve their relationships. So communication, and it can also allow other people that the client is affiliated with to gain insight into their behavior. So if it's a family member, a spouse, friends, it's like, oh, now I understand why you aren't fulfilling these types of responsibilities, or you're not returning my phone calls, or it's hard to have a conversation with you. This all makes sense. And then I think the other piece is, like I had said before, is it just helps guide the next step. So interventions, strategies, treatment, and in the case for children, it can help with educational type supports. So if they need any additional supports or accommodations at school, it can be very valuable.
I'm curious, what does the typical report look like or the feedback look like?
So the reports, in reference to my own style, tend to be pretty comprehensive. The evaluations are tailored towards the individual. There's often a very thorough history, background, going all the way back to childhood. And we even talk about pregnancy and prenatal care and so on. And we may look at learning. We may do an IQ test. We may look at memory processing, again, because a learning issue may be at the forefront when somebody's thinking, oh, I really have an attention issue. The evaluation is going to cover a lot of different areas of potentially IQ. In the case of looking at achievement, if we need to look at academics, we're doing testing and, like I said, attention capacity. And then more of the social emotional functioning to rule out whether there's anything else going on, like anxiety, depression, any type of mood disorder, anything going on with personality functioning. So the report is going to really give a comprehensive picture of everything, including the scores, the standardized scores, a interpretation, a write-up, the results, and then all of the recommendations for next steps. It tends to be pretty comprehensive and thorough. And then the feedback session is done in person or through telehealth. And that's an overview of all of the results and recommendations.
It's a very thorough evaluation. How long does that generally take?
On the lengthier side. So it starts with the consultation to get that history and background information, determine the type of evaluation that is appropriate. And then the testing, the way I conduct it, and a lot of providers do it differently, is typically over the course of 2 to 3 sessions. And they are 3 to 4 hours each. And that allows me to gain a picture of somebody on different days, because we all know we may come in and we're really tired and we're not doing our best. And I want to really get an idea of how somebody's looking over the course of a couple sessions. It's also a lot for somebody to do at one time. And then that all that information is compiled and, like I said, put into the report. So depending on the amount of testing, the number of appointments, it could take a little bit of time.
Well, and it makes sense that you would break it down. A lot of these assessments I know you're doing with children, it would be a lot all in one block of time. I think it makes a lot of sense that it would be over multiple sessions. So what does it look like when you work with a clinician who has referred to you? What could they expect as a clinician?
So generally, if a referral is made to me from a clinician, once I have a release to speak with the provider, I will often get some information from his or her perspective of what they're seeing, observing, what the client has been reporting, what is leading them to seek an evaluation, what they're hoping for in terms of the evaluation. And then that information is always very valuable in the assessment process. And then if the client is continuing the treatment and therapy with that clinician thereafter, it's a good opportunity to circle back and talk through the results. I always encourage the client to share the results with their clinician. And it's something that if they give a release to do, I am happy to talk through those results with the clinician and talk about treatment planning and interventions and strategies that may best suit that client. But it is a really key component because the clinician has really good insight. And often I find that clinicians provide information to me that I'm not able to glean from the client per se. So it does help a great deal.
Yeah, I would think it gives you a much more comprehensive picture of everything that's going on. I think you did a terrific job with putting so much information out there for clinicians. Is there anything else that we didn't cover that you feel like is really important for clinicians to know with regard to ADHD or assessment?
I would say the one thing that tends to be mistaken about ADHD is clients will often say, I struggle with one particular aspect of my attention and my attention span, yet I'm able to almost hyper-focus on something, whether it's a craft or a hobby or something else. And that is the hallmark of it. And that goes with children as well. They'll say, well, my child can play video games for hours, or they can sit and do an activity that they really enjoy. And I think what people may not know about ADHD is there is this ability to have some intense concentration and focus on things that are very stimulating and engaging. And it tends to be the other things that are not as engaging that are a struggle for them. And then the last thing I would say is there's a lot out there. I don't know if you're familiar with it or your clinicians are, but there's a whole thing out there called executive functioning. And executive functioning is really associated with ADHD. For those people that don't know what executive functioning is, I kind of think of it as like the air traffic control tower of like managing a busy airport, and how do we deal with the planning and the prioritizing and just kind of keeping everything in motion and moving forward. And so in a nutshell, executive functioning is really looking ahead at just like planning things, prioritizing, being able to manage time, being flexible between different types of tasks. And so that is a big aspect of ADHD, all those associated skills that people will often hear that term. So I think it's important for those two things. And I guess like the last thing I would say is when we talk about strategies with ADHD, we talk about treatment. I mentioned before, it's not a one size fits all. It's not like I tried this, okay, throw it out the window and I'm done. We build the toolbox. We decide what to pull out at any given time. It may work on one occasion in one context and it may not. So that's a really, really important piece. What I talk about with my clients is sometimes they'll come and say, well, I tried it, it's not working, or I tried it this week and it's better, but the next week it doesn't feel like it's moved. And what I try to keep in mind and try to share with them is success doesn't mean that it's going to be perfect, right? It means that you're potentially doing better than last week.
I agree. And I'm glad that you brought that up too, because I think so many people, when it comes to treatment of ADHD, they think of one thing, and that's medication. And that may be a tool in the toolbox. And of course, neither you nor I are prescribing. That would be something that you would have an MD do. But it is something that you have to realize is, like you said, there's a toolbox and everybody's toolbox may look a little bit different.
Yes. And what may work for you in some circumstances may not work for other people. We really have to figure out what works best for the client.
Right. So helpful. And I'm so glad you mentioned that piece of the hyper-focus, because I think that can really throw us off. We look at it and say, can't be ADHD because they can focus for hours on, as you said, playing video games, watching a video, whatever it is that holds their attention, but it still can be ADHD.
Yes, that's correct.
All super helpful, Rachel. So I so appreciate it. Thank you for being here. All of your contact info is going to be in the notes section of the podcast so that people will be able to get to you if they are wanting to. Tell everybody, too, where your office is located, because you're in the Atlanta
yes.
area.
So my practice is Powers Ferry Psychological Associates. We have four offices. My office, where I am based out of, is in Marietta. For those that are familiar with location, it's on Powers Ferry Road, just right off the Windy Hill exit, off of 75. I welcome anyone to contact me via email or phone if they have additional questions, they're seeking a referral, would just like to talk further, consult on a case. I welcome the opportunity to do that.
Perfect. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you so much, Jackie. I appreciate it.
Music for this podcast has been provided by Audionautix.com. This podcast is purely informational and is not a replacement for supervision. Thank you for listening.